So most of the conclusions of the Varkari Sampradaya seem to be pure devotional. And is it personal or is it impersonal? Firstly, we have to stop thinking in terms of or. As I said, or is the common mode of thinking in passion. And is the mode of thinking in goodness. So, you have to speak of some Varkari Sampradaya, which is largely devotional. Even people who may be associated with impersonalist organizations, they may also not be impersonalist themselves. See, there are, in India, in general, anybody who becomes spiritual, they think, lean on I. They think that is the whole of life, to merge into one. And they have not really thought of that very philosophically deeply. That is just a general conception that is there. So there are nominal impersonalists and there are hardcore impersonalists. Hardcore impersonalists are those who actually say that we have to go beyond the form of Krishna, and they say the form of Krishna is illusion. But nominal impersonalists are just, this is a conception that they have acquired from the cultural upbringing that they have got, or from whatever readings little bit they have done here and there. It's not that they have intellectually deliberated on personalism and impersonalism and come to the conclusion of impersonalism. So, Ramanuja's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita is translated, there are many translations of it, but one of the best translations is, I think, by Swami Atmanivedananda, somebody like that. Now, he was a sannyasi in a Mayavadi organization, an impersonalist organization. But in the foreword, it is written that although he belonged to the impersonal organization, throughout his life, he was a practicing Vaishnava. Now, how he reconciled his Vaishnavism with the impersonalism of that organization, we don't know. But his commentary, what he says, it's not commentary, it's translation of Ramanuja's commentary. It's from the point of view of the accuracy of the translations, it is the best among whatever is available. Even Sri Vaishnavas recommend it. So the point is that we can't just label people based on their institutional affiliation. Even when people are within an institution, they are individuals ultimately. And they have their own understandings. So, even among impersonalists, there are different degrees of impersonalists. Some may be very favorable to devotion also. And they may almost have devotional understandings. And if you present things properly, they will become devotees. Proper devotees. Others, there will be some who are hostile also. And we may have to keep a distance from them. So it's important that we not judge or label people, or to speak of whole organizations. See, an organization may have some official ideology, but it is not that every organization's individual's worldview is congruent to that organization's ideology. Every individual is different. Even in this moment itself, if you ask, what is Krishna consciousness to each of you? If you are going to give a rote, rapid definition, it's a Krishna consciousness to remember Krishna constantly. That's what we may say. But if we are asked, what is our understanding of Krishna consciousness? We may all give different understandings. What does it mean to be Krishna conscious? So, like that, we shouldn't label people based on their institutional affiliations. Each individual is different. And let us see what is their understanding and present accordingly. Broadly speaking, even what we call the Varkari movement, it's a very big and influential movement in Maharashtra especially. And it has been shaped by a large tradition of states, starting from Ganeshwar. There were some before also, but Ganeshwar was the most prominent. And down to Tukaram, and there have been other saints also. Now some of them, they have been personalists, some of them have been impersonalists. And there has been some internal tension between them also. So, for example, Tukaram Maharaj is in many places quite strongly condemning impersonalism. And there are many places where Ganeshwar seems to be promoting impersonalism. But there is no direct point where Tukaram Maharaj is criticizing Ganeshwar, as far as I have seen. He criticizes the ideology of impersonalism. So now, whether Ganeshwar was actually speaking impersonalism, or whether he was using some words and phrases which had a different meaning at that time and which have a different meaning now to us, we don't know that. So it's difficult to, as I said, again, when we have a category of personalism and impersonalism. it's very difficult to fit real life institutions in a neat intellectual map. It's like in the border there will be a disputed territory. So is this disputed territory in India or Pakistan? It's difficult to say, be partially there. So in real life, within even one saint's writings, may also, there might be something which can seem impersonalistic. Even Bhagavatam itself, you read, there are some sections. At the end of the Ramayana, at the end of the Ramlila, in the 9th canto, it says, thus Lord Ram, after placing his feet in the hearts of his devotees, entered into the Brahma Jyoti. Atma Jyoti Ragataha. What is this? Ram went to Brahma Jyoti. Where are we going to do if we worship Ram? We may say. Now the problem here is that when Bhagavatam uses the word Atma Jyoti, what is it referring to? Words have, this is a little subtle subject, but we have to understand that words have technical meanings and words have general meanings. So for example, if a scientist is doing research in a laboratory and he tells us, we have run out of energy. Probably what he means is maybe the battery is discharged or they have some power transformer or power generator which has run out of power. But when he comes back to home and he tells his wife, I have run out of energy now. He's not using it, there's no battery inside. He's saying, I'm exhausted. So here the word energy is used in a non-technical sense. So it's just that the same word energy can be used in a technical sense in some place and a non-technical sense in some place, by the same person. Similarly, the word is Brahma Jyoti or Brahman or Atma or what is the word for superimposition? Aropa, not Aropa. Anyway, so there's a concept of superimposition within the impersonalism. That material illusion has been superimposed on Brahman. So these are all conceptions that are there, but what they mean in particular contexts is very difficult to say. The Bhagavatam is not giving a philosophical analysis over that. It's just narrating a past time. And then it's not that every reference to the Jyoti has to necessarily refer to Brahma Jyoti. It just refers to the material world is Tamasoma Jyotirgama. Now, Tamasoma Jyotirgama is a famous Upanishadic aphorism. It simply means go from darkness to light. It doesn't necessarily go from the material world to Brahma Jyoti and merge in Brahma Jyoti. There, the word Jyoti is used in a general sense. It is not used in a technical sense to refer to Brahma Jyoti. So, like that, there are words which can be used in a general sense, and we may assume that they are referring to a technical sense. And we can get confused. So, in general, it's good, it's safe. It's sensitive to not judge or label people in a very generic sense. Try to understand what their philosophy is. And even when Prabhupada also trained devotees that if somebody would ask, what do you think of this? Prabhupada, what is their philosophy? What is their philosophy? Now, one reason for asking this question is, even if somebody says that, okay, what do you think about so-and-so spiritual teacher? Now, what is their philosophy? When you ask this question, we are not just differentiating that person from their philosophy. We are also differentiating that person from this questioner's understanding of his philosophy. There are three different things. That person, his philosophy, and this questioner's understanding of his philosophy. So, sometimes we may counter the philosophy and then this person is an impersonalist. It's like we are shooting on target at the wrong target. So here is the person, here is the person's philosophy, and here is this questioner's understanding of his philosophy. So for example, there is a famous impersonalist teacher. Now, everybody in India who is a spiritualist, they have heard of this teacher. But most of the thing that they have heard about him is, you know, he went to Chicago and he gave a talk and everybody, he said, my brothers and sisters, and everybody clapped hands. And he has a very, very impressive looking pose and maybe some isolated quotes here and there. And that is all people know about him. And if we come back heavy, hey, he was an impersonalist. I didn't even know he was an impersonalist. So what happens is, when people certain needs, whether it be of pertinent spiritual teachers or whether it be of certain organizations, people have sentiments associated with them. And if we criticize them, we may be factually also wrong, because as I said, we cannot put a particular organization or individual philosophy down neatly in any map, intellectual map. So we may be wrong itself, and even if we are not wrong, you know, when it comes to specific names, people have sentiments associated with them. And when we alienate, when we hurt the sentiments, then their intellect closes down. And afterwards, whatever we say doesn't make sense to them, because they're not rational at that time. They become emotional. So, in general, it's good not to make specific statements about any particular organization or individual unless we have a proper background in which we understand this. Like I answered about Ambedkar just now. So I gave a whole background about where he was coming from, how he formed his views, and what the whole social context was. So without that, just making a judgment, single statement in there, that's Maya or the organization, or he's Maya, it can be very alienating for people. So best to avoid direct labeling of anyone, any organization or any individual belonging to a particular organization. Second is, even when you come to the philosophy, we may refute their philosophy, a particular philosophy, but that may not be that person's understanding of that philosophy. That person, for example, may be attracted to a particular organization simply because that organization practices some kind of Vedic culture. Somebody likes Goseva, and there is some impersonalist organization that is doing Goseva very nicely. And this person is attracted to that organization primarily because of Goseva. Now, if you condemn that organization for that for its impersonalism, that impersonalism is never an attractive point for that person. So we are not hitting the target only. So if that person is attracted to Goseva, present how Krishna conscious movement is also doing Goseva. And then explain how Krishna consciousness movement reflects the Vedic Siddhanta more precisely. So that way we can interact. See what is it, rather than saying, oh, this person belongs to this organization. Understand that he's an individual. And find out what is it that attracts this individual to this organization. And then explain how that same need or that same interest can be addressed in the Krishna consciousness movement. And it does not mean that the person will shift immediately to Krishna consciousness, but at least that person will start developing an appreciation for Krishna consciousness. And gradually from that appreciation, we can bring them closer and closer till they come to Krishna. It's like that if you consider two mountains. This is the Krishna consciousness movement. This is a mountain of Krishna conscious wisdom. This person is on some other mountain. Some other ideas he has got. So now we want to attract them. The first thing we need to do is build a bridge. Build a bridge. That bridge building means helping them appreciate Krishna consciousness. And then as they start exploring, they start walking across the bridge. And when they have walked across to this side of the bridge, when they have developed faith in the authorities in Krishna consciousness movement, at least some level, then we can break the bridge. That means we can counter the misconceptions, whatever they might be. But if even before they start walking across the bridge, we break the bridge only, and they are going to stay there forever. Isn't it? Worst is, after they have walked halfway across the bridge, we break the bridge. Somebody is worshipping Ganesh, and then that person started appreciating Krishna. Ganesh is not God, Krishna is God. No, but this Puran says this, that Puran says this. And that person gets confused and he says, hey, this religion business is very confusing. Let me become an atheist. But we did not do any service. The person had some level of Devata Puja he was doing. Give that up because of the confusion. So we have to focus at least in the initial stages on building bridges. And our communication of our philosophy, our presentation of our message, and our statements about their message, about whatever they are believing or practicing right now, they all should focus on bridge building. And after the bridge has been built, in due course, there can be the clarification of misconception, but that will come much later. Does that answer your question? Thank you. We'll continue.